morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. So for the record, today's date is November 17th, 2021. This court has four matters before it today. Three of those are being heard orally. I see that we have now turned to the second matter on our calendar. We have the lawyers appearing in front of us, and I know your mics and your video have been checked. So what I'll do is ask the marshal to call the second case on our calendar so our record is clear.
Now calling case A210505, Brad Allen Fries versus Elizabeth Farr Fries.
Right, and before we begin the second matter on the calendar, I just want to say a few things. First of all, you know what to do. I realize you have some instructions if you lose contact with us or have difficulty. We're very grateful we're able to proceed by video conference today for the oral arguments during the pandemic. That is the only part of our procedure that's changed. You're not in a courtroom, but all of our other procedures are exactly the same as in a courtroom. And so I appreciate your following them or asking us questions if you have any questions. So you're probably familiar with the manner in which we're going to proceed and the time limits that are in place. Before you start your argument, if you would please identify yourself for the record, as well as the client that you represent. And that's in order to keep our audio recording clear. That will later be posted on the court's website. And then if you'll keep your eye on the clock, there are 15 minutes allotted for each side, 5 minutes for rebuttal. It tends to go quickly, and we really appreciate having the lawyers here to address our questions. So with that, we are ready to proceed. And counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Todd Haugen, Your Honor, and I'm here present representing Elizabeth Fries, who's in my office. And if it pleases the court and counsel, I'll refer to the parties as I referred to in the appellate brief, my client, the respondent in the trial court, is the appellant here, and the petitioner in the trial court is the respondent here. Based on past experience, I'm sure the court has read the appeal, appellate brief, and the reply to respondent's response, and therefore I'm not going to get real carried away with the facts, but I think if this is a court of equity, one of the things I'm constrained to point out, and it's mentioned in the brief, is that the parties were divorced in April 15 of 2015. Approximately 90 days later, July 31, 2015, she had a net worth of about $160,000. And according to our expert, Mr. Fries, the respondent had a net worth in excess of $4 million. The reason for that is he owned a 20% interest in a company called Stonebridge Construction, Inc. I refer to that often as SCI or Stonebridge. And he, of course, will say that he had no interest prior to the party's dissolution of their marriage. We believe we have evidence to the contrary. There's some suggestion that this motion should have brought earlier. I'm constrained to point out that she did not know that he owned an interest in Stonebridge until July of 2018, more than 3 years after the judgment decree was entered. And the reason for that is that he refused to give her his 2015 tax return, which he should have given her because that set the bar for what we call tier two spousal maintenance. Rather, he said, you don't need it. I made the max. Here's your check. You don't get the tax return. Well, fortuitously, somewhere after that, he brought a motion to change child support.
And Mr. Todd?
Ordered.
Mr. Todd? So, yes. Sorry to interrupt, but as you noted earlier, we are familiar with the record and we read the record. And you actually raised an issue. I thought I would ask later, but since you raised it already, you indicated that there's evidence that husband had a 20% interest in Stonebridge prior to the entry of the judgment and decree. What is the specific evidence you have to show that he did have a 20% interest in it prior to entry of that judgment and decree?
There are four things I'd point to. One is there's a pledge agreement that was in the record before the case was settled. And Mr. Fries was buying an interest in a limited partnership, a real estate limited partnership that was created by his employer. And he borrowed money to obtain that interest. And he borrowed the money from Credit River Mortgage, which is apparently a bank or a lending institution that's owned directly or indirectly by his employer, Stonebridge. In that document, there's a paragraph that says both the pledgor, which would be Mr. Freeze, and the pledgee, which would be Credit River Mortgage, owned an interest in the general contractor that is involved in this transaction. The only general contractor was Stonebridge Construction, Inc. Now, admittedly, that issue was raised prior to the judgment and decree being entered, and Mr. Freeze effectively said, it's a typo, it doesn't matter, I don't have any interest. In retrospect, now that we know he owned the interest within 90 days, approximately, of entry to judgment and decree, my client is re-examining that and thinking that is a smoking gun that showed he actually did have an interest. That's
now, counsel, that was all of that was presented to the district court, and the district court made some credibility determinations about that argument, correct?
That's correct, except one of my cases makes clear that for purposes of a summary judgment motion or a Rule 12 motion, which is we were dismissed on a Rule 12 motion, the court is supposed to take as true everything stated in our affidavit and give us the benefit of the doubt.
Here, now, was it a Rule 12 motion? Wasn't it a Rule 60-02 motion?
The motion to dismiss was a Rule 12 motion, and we were granted the right to do discovery. We amended our motion, basically asking the same thing to reopen, but various other subject matters involved. And ultimately,
help me a little bit procedurally here. So what you're trying to do is reopen the judgment and decree, right?
Correct.
So that's a Rule 60 motion.
It's also min stat 518.145 subdivision 2 and Rule 60-02. Yes.
Okay.
And there's case law talking about what you're talking about. Rule 60-02 says it's exempt from divorce decrees, but it really means you can't open the divorce. They remain divorced. So again, prior judge asked what evidence we have. We have that evidence. And when you couple that with what I call the tortured language about defining income, quote, employment income, I see that as a smoking gun that he knew he owned or was going to have an interest in Stonebridge. That's why he tried to isolate from his income for purposes of determining tier two spousal maintenance, quote, dividend income.
So, counsel, I have a question about that as well. I did not see in your brief an argument that the term employment income is ambiguous. Am I correct? Am I correct in your position is that that's an unambiguous term, susceptible only to one reasonable interpretation?
I'm suggesting that in my brief that income, employment income, has to include any income paid to someone by his or her employer.
Well, that's not quite my question. My question is whether the term employment income is unambiguous, susceptible only to one reasonable interpretation, or ambiguous, susceptible to more than one reasonable interpretation.
It's not a defined term. We start there. It's not defined in the judgment and decree. It's not defined in the case law I can find. So I will concede it's ambiguous. But I suggest the only reasonable interpretation is that any income from one's employer should be included for purposes of determining spousal maintenance. But I think I'm answering your question. The bigger issue there is why even use these words? Because he already distinguished dividend income in two separate limited partnerships that he admitted he owned. They weren't going to be included. Why didn't he just say earnings or wages? And the reason is he knew that he owned an interest in Stonebridge or would soon own one, and he wanted to exclude that dividend income from consideration for purposes of spousal maintenance.
Well, Mr. Todd, I mean, I hate to put words into respondent's mouth, but I suspect the argument will be that that wasn't included in the judgment, original judgment and decree, because he didn't have an interest in it. I understand your argument as well. No, there was smoke here, and where there's smoke, there's fire. But I want to go back to the issue of investment income, and I think Judge Frisch is on the right track, and I had the same thought of, is that language ambiguous? I understand it's not defined by the judgment and decree, but I thought I heard you say that you conceded it was ambiguous, but that there's only one reasonable interpretation. But in order to be ambiguous, there has to be two or more reasonable interpretations. And I think these words really matter in terms of what is meant by employment income. My question to you, my first question to you on that is, does employment income include investment income?
Well, the closest I could get to a definition is I looked at the statute 518A.29 and 0.30, and they both define income broadly. And 0.30 specifically talks about income from privately held businesses, I'm paraphrasing, or corporations. And then the Haefeli case further says that was a case involving income from a privately held company. It included that for purposes of determining income. That's as close
as I can. What do you make of the fact that income is treated, or sources of revenue, I'll call it that, are treated differently in the judgment and decree? For example, there is investment income that's treated in one way, and there's wages that are treated in a different way. So what do you make of that when you look at the judgment and decree as a whole?
Well, what I make of it, he wanted to not include dividend income from the flats at Cedar Grove. That's a limited partnership. That was agreed to. And he wanted to eliminate income from what's called Lakeville Woods, another limited partnership in which he held an interest. Those were excluded from income for purposes of determining spousal maintenance.
Investment income.
Correct. But again, I sound like a broken record. Having defined those two entities and then excluding them, why did we add this language? And it would only be to cover dividend income from Stonebridge, which he either knew he was going to have or had at that time. And I want to divert just briefly to the question, what evidence I have. There are multiple purchase agreements created before the judgment decree was entered, essentially selling Mr. Freeze 20% of Stonebridge for $200,000. He said they were dead. They didn't happen. They weren't signed. 90 days after the decree, he bought 20% interest pretty much on those same terms.
Well, I think the record indicates, Mr. Todd, I think the record indicates that, or let me rephrase this. The district court found that they did not enter into that agreement until, what was it, December of 2016, and they essentially backdated the agreement to July of 2015, so he could get tax benefits from it. But that the district court found that the agreement had not been entered into and signed until December 2016, correct?
Correct. And I only have 3 minutes here. And if I'm allowed only to make one point, my biggest point is this: that fact that you articulated correctly, that the court found, is absolutely contradicted by irrefutable evidence before the court. And the irrefutable evidence is Mr. Freeze's 2015 individual tax return, which includes a K-1 from Stonebridge that had to have been created before October 3 of 2016, because that's the date on the tax return. That absolutely negates two affidavits from his employers that said just what you said, that he didn't even own an interest until December 31, 2016. Those affidavits are absolutely incorrect. Therefore, they have no credibility, and in my opinion, they should have been dismissed. Even what's this burden of proof here? I say it's de novo, and I briefed it. Even if it wasn't de novo, the court's finding of fact on that issue as to when he obtained an interest in Stonebridge are directly contradicted by the irrefutable evidence before the court, and that's the 2015 individual income tax return of Mr. Freeze.
Well, and just to be clear, for findings of fact, generally we review those for clear error, correct?
Correct. But this is my bigger point. We shouldn't even be talking about findings of fact. It's a Rule 12 motion, which sometimes morphs into a motion for summary judgment. Under either one of those scenarios, I have case law that's I don't think can be contradicted, that says you must assume all the facts in the light most favorable to the claimant. And assuming all of that, there's not a genuine issue of material fact, then you dismiss. I say that if you assume the facts articulated in the appellant's affidavit and the documents appended thereto or filed therewith, there is absolutely a prima facie case that Mr. Freeze owned Stonebridge prior to entry of the judgment and decree. And my final point, if I might be allowed to make it, the trial judge asked a good question. Actually, counsel, the opposing counsel, nobody gave him anything. Why are we complaining about it? He bought it. Well, the answer is his right to buy it was a property interest. I couldn't have bought it. The court couldn't have bought it. His right to buy this $2 million interest, $4 million interest for $200,000 was a property interest, and he denied that he had it. My client relied upon that denial to her detriment, and at the end of the day, she received nothing, and Mr. Freeze has a $4 million asset. My time is up. Unless the court has a question, I think I'm done, other than my five-minute rebuttal.
Any other questions? Okay. And as you mentioned, Mr. Haugen, you do have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. But we are resetting the clock right now. And there it is. So we are ready to hear from respondent. You can go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's Peter Glickel on behalf of the respondent, Bradley Freeze. The record's clear. This is not a Rule 12 motion. It was not a summary judgment. The order from which the appellant appealed was a district court's March 21 order, and I'm going to quote it. Order denying respondent's motion to reopen judgment and decree. The basis for that motion was alleged fraud. Under Shirk against Shirk, Rule 60 doesn't come into play here. Minnesota Statute 518.145 Subdivision 2 is the statute under which the motion necessarily has to be brought. I will emphasize again, because the argument that this court is to review the lower court's ruling on the motion to reopen on a de novo basis is flatly wrong. And quite frankly, it's intellectually dishonest. The court, in addition to the title of its order, indicates, and this is at the appendix at pages 9 through 10, quote, respondent's motion is denied in its entirety. Respondent did bring a Rule 12 motion. And at appendix 9, the conclusion of the district court was, and I quote again, in sum, there's no basis for finding any misrepresentation or non-disclosure on the part of petitioner of the lower court, husband here, that would warrant reopening the judgment and decree. This is an abuse of discretion standard. The law is clear. Thompson against Thompson stands for that proposition, as does a whole host of cases that we cited to in our brief. There was no Rule 12 motion. There was no summary judgment motion. The record's clear. Wife, appellant here, brought a motion to reopen the judgment and decree for fraud. Originally, what the court did on the original motion was to stay a ruling on that motion, gave wife time to conduct additional discovery, and to, quote, renew that motion within 180 days. Wife did no additional discovery, did not renew in 180 days, renewed about a year later, but it doesn't change the procedural posture of this case. It was a new motion to set aside the judgment and decree for fraud.
Mr. Glickel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, I have a question. I want to go more to the substantive, and I want to go to a point that opposing counsel raised, and that is with respect to the K-1 filing. And unless I missed it, I did not see you address that in your brief at all. Can you please explain why this K-1 filing that shows that husband had an ownership interest prior to October 3rd of 2016, why this does not show that the district court's finding, in fact, is clearly erroneous?
I'd be happy to, Your Honor. If we go back to the record, and this is all substantiated in the record, and it's substantiated in documents 120, 124, and 125, Mr. Freeh's affidavit, Mr. Chase's affidavit, and Mr. Erskine's affidavit. Contrary, again, a misstatement of the record. The record below shows Mr. Freeh testified in his affidavit that it was the latter half of 2015, after the judgment decree was entered. He went back to the owners of Stonebridge Construction, renewed his request for a buy-in. As early as January of 2016, there was an email as part of the record that one of the owners, Mr. Anderson, sent saying, I want to have a meeting to understand this proposal so that we can hopefully move forward and get this done. That's January 16, after Mr. Freeh had renewed the discussions or request to renew their discussions in the latter half of 2015. The record also shows that in June of 2016, Mr. Chase, the majority owner and the managing member, sent an email to his lawyer saying, draft up an agreement, simple agreement for Mr. Freeh to buy in. There was some massaging of the actual document itself, such that the document itself didn't get signed until December of 16. But if you take a look at the timeline, the discussions are renewed in the latter half of 15. Mr. Anderson in January says, yeah, I want to look at this. I want to get this deal done. Let's have a meeting about the proposal. In June of 16, Mr. Chase, who's really running the show here as a majority owner and managing member, says, get me to his lawyer, get me an agreement drafted up real simply. What that shows is, Your Honor, is that the parties at least had a meeting of the minds by the middle of 16 that this deal was going to get done. They still had to paper it, but that Mr. Freeh was going to be allowed to buy in the 20% that the record reflects. The record's also clear, as Judge Sullivan found, that part of the request and part of the agreement was that they were going to make the purchase effective in 15, as of July, the end of July 15, so that Mr. Freeh could potentially take advantage of the real estate tax professional tax benefits. So what you have is kind of similar to what you were talking about in the earlier case. You have an agreement, a meeting of the minds as to what's going to be done here. It doesn't get finally papered till the end of the year, but all concerned parties are in agreement that we're going to do this deal and to facilitate the part of the deal that Mr. Freeh had requested and that the other owners had agreed upon to make it effective in 15, we need to get that K-1 out in October of 16 so that he can take that advantage on his 2015 tax return. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
So that sounds like there was an agreement prior to December of 2016 then, correct?
In principle, yes.
Okay, so the district court's finding of fact that there wasn't an agreement until December of 2016 is erroneous then?
There was no written agreement until December 16th.
You don't have to have written agreement, though, in order to have an agreement, though, correct? You can have an oral agreement.
Well, you can have an oral agreement on which the parties could base their conduct. I mean, you're going to have a written agreement with respect to a statute of frauds argument, but in principle, yes. But even if you accept that, Judge, even if you accept that, that's October of 16. It's more than a year after the entry of the judgment and decree. It's still after the entry of the decree. There's no marital interest. I mean, wife is arguing one of two things. It's in her brief. Either he was a, quote, de facto owner, and there's nothing on the record to reflect that, or he had an intent, a desire, which was fully disclosed during the dissolution, to become an owner. So if we just focus on the first argument, which is the only one that would carry any water here, is that he would have had been an owner or had a right to become an owner, as Mr. Haugen has argued, as of the date of the decree. And there's nothing on the record to reflect that as of that date, there was any agreement, written or otherwise, that Mr. Freeh would become an owner, a a minority owner in Stonebridge.
Well, you make it sound like in 2016, they basically started on a blank slate, but there is evidence in the record that there were drafts and that he did have an intent to want to become an owner for many years. And that was established even before the judgment decree was entered. I have two follow-up questions on that. When I look at the record, you state that that wife knew of husband's desire to obtain an ownership interest in Stonebridge, but then husband also testified that he did not. It seems that husband was testifying contrary to what he claims wife knew. So I'm wondering which is true.
Your Honor, with all due respect, I don't believe that Mr. Freeze ever testified that he did not have an intent or a desire. During the dissolution, Mr. Freeze, Mr. Ariston, and Mr. Chase were all deposed. And we produced in the dissolution draft documents that Mr. Freeze, on his own nickel, had approached a lawyer to prepare. That was all disclosed in the dissolution. Wife's attorney at the time, Mr. Skolnick, questioned Mr. Freeze, Mr. Chase, and Mr. Aristad, not only about whether or not Mr. Freeze was an owner, or if there was an existing agreement that he would become an owner, that if he had a right to become an owner at the time, but that he had approached the owners with the draft documents, and that there was no agreement at that time for Mr. Freeze to buy in. And Mr. Freeze had always disclosed his desire, his intent. And in fact, at the lower level, within wife's affidavit, she says that she knew during the marriage that Mr. Freeze was desirous, had tried earlier to buy into Stonebridge, but was unsuccessful. So that desire had always been disclosed. And in fact, at the original motion to set aside in front of the lower court, my argument was that a desire to purchase an asset with no property right to do so is not a marital right. There's no marital property in a desire to buy something. And there's case law out there that demonstrates that. If you have a desire, it's like in Kornberg.
So I have one additional question, and, yes. And thank you for the answer in terms of the filing tax returns prior to October 2016, because it wasn't clear to me, and it sounds like you are in agreement that, in fact, he did do that and that there was an interest that he had prior to that. My question is with respect to the agreement that had been finally entered into in December of 2016. Now, that agreement backdated the effective date, which in and of itself seems to create issues. But let's put that aside for the second. Let me ask this. What was the tax benefit that husband received by having the effective date of 2015?
What it does is it allows husband a year earlier, not in 16, but in 15, to take advantage of tax benefits to real estate tax professionals, whether it's accelerated depreciation or the like. Whether or not it's in fact something that Mr. Freeze was able to take advantage of on his 2015 tax return, I candidly can't answer that, but I do know that as a real estate tax professional, if one qualifies as such, the Internal Revenue Code does allow that type of person additional tax benefits that people like myself that are not a real estate tax professional don't have the opportunity to take advantage of.
Thank you.
Sure. The other issue I'd like to touch on, I've only got 2 minutes, is the issue with respect to the Tier 2 spousal maintenance. The court has asked counsel whether or not it was ambiguous or not. Our belief is that it is not, that it is clearly distinguishable from the calculation of, quote, gross income, which is a term and is defined in the statute under 518. Cap 8.29, so that there is a difference between gross income, which would include not only wages and salaries, but dividends, investment income, and the like, which does distinguish it. Now, even if the court were to find that it was ambiguous, which is admittedly subject to de novo review at this court, the meaning and the effect of that provision is a question for the lower court to determine and would be analyzed on an abuse of discretion standard. And Judge Sullivan, having had the entire judgment and decree in front of her, understanding that employment income is certainly distinguishable from gross income as used in the statute for purposes of calculating child support and today's spousal maintenance, differs. And that at the time, the only two investment properties that, this couple owned were Lakeville Woods and Cedar Grove.
So why isn't, I have a follow-up question on that. Why isn't this dividend income considered part of employment income? Because this is not income that you or I or anybody else could invest in. This is, he's investing in and he is now an owner. So why isn't that part of his employment income?
Because he's still, as the record would reveal below with respect to the child support issues and what have you, he's still, as the president of the company, receiving salary and wages. So there's a difference. His salary and wages are still being paid. It's not like where you have a sole business owner for perhaps.
Right. But just because, I mean, anybody who, even lawyers who work at a company, can receive dividends or shares of the company as income, as dividends, as and those are considered part of your employment income.
Yes.
And so why wouldn't that be the same thing here?
Well, it would be different because in that situation, Your Honor, for example, in my situation as a partner here, that's all I get is K-1. I don't get a salary and wages. I have a draw, and then I have a bonus, which is considered income, but I don't also get a salary and wages. In this case, Mr. Freeze continued to be paid in his role as the president of the company, a salary and wages. Any income that might accrue as a result of an ownership interest in Stonebridge is K-1 income, and it is investment income. Would be income on the $200,000 purchase price. Go ahead, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, go ahead, you may.
Well, here's what was argued to try to bootstrap this into the Tier 2 is an expert by the name of Mr. Burning engaged in a hypothetical that business owners could move income back and forth. That was the foundation for the argument. But as the lower court found, as a 20% owner, not a majority owner nor the managing member, Mr. Freeze had no ability to recharacterize anything. That was the crux of their argument below. Here again, and I know I'm repeating myself, he's still receiving salary and wages, employment income, line 7 of the tax return.
Judge Bradfield, if I may ask just one quick follow-up question.
Go ahead.
Thank you. This should be a short answer. This should just be yes or no, but you characterize it as an either or. Either you have salary and wages or you have dividends and bonuses, like as if you can only have one or the other. But I know that people can have both and both of those can be considered income. Isn't that true that you can have salary, wages, as well as bonuses or dividends as part of your income?
Yes, as part of your gross income.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, and that's what the statute defines it as gross income would be all those sources. But gross income is not employment income. They're different.
No, I think we understand. Thank you, counsel. Much appreciated. So just so appellant is aware, we did take some extra time with respondents' counsel. Typically, that washes out in the 5 minutes that you get for rebuttal. But if at some point you feel you need to expand on your answer, you can certainly ask for permission to continue it, and we'll enlarge the clock. Or if one of the panel members would like to do that. So, counsel for appellant, we are ready for you to begin your rebuttal argument. Thank you.
Okay, I'll take it perhaps in reverse order since we're talking about the income. I'm constrained to point out that I think no one can disagree that questions of law, this court looks at de novo. Questions of fact is a reversible error standard. I agree with that. It's clear to me that there's absolutely no factual issue with respect to the issue of Tier 2 spousal maintenance. We know what Mr. Freeze earned. We know whether it was dividend income or wages. And it's this court can look at it de novo. And my argument is that it's obvious that employment income is any income from one's employer. And I defer, again, I refer to 518.29 and 518.29 and A.30 that defines income, and nowhere does it exclude dividend income. Counsel mentioned gross income. Well, of course, child support and spousal maintenance under current law are both based on gross income. So I would ask the court to review that. I would ask the court simply to enter judgment for $57,000, which is a balance due for Tier 1 spousal maintenance. Now, moving on to my next point, it's an absolute fact that the respondent's first motion was a Rule 12 motion to dismiss. It was deferred. Ruling on it was deferred to give us time to do discovery and come back. The court granted that motion by dismissing our case. Rule 12 and motions are absolutely reviewed de novo. It's a legal question. 518.145, which is the statute on which this is based, is a jurisdictional statute. If you don't meet it, there is no jurisdiction. We have cited case law that says that jurisdictional issues are legal issues to be determined.
Oh, counsel, before you go to the legal issues, I guess what convinced me that the district court had decided and rejected your motion to reopen on the merits was the language of the district court's order and the fact that discovery had occurred and evidence was presented. So that the judge was in fact deciding the motion to reopen, not dismissing your request to reopen as a under Rule 12. So that's what I see at the end of the district court's decision. Can you help me out there?
My response there is that there was no trial. There were no witnesses. I couldn't cross-examine anyone. And I've pointed out cases where the court has reversed trial courts for not giving due credit to affidavits. And I think that's what happened here. By making fact findings based on a record with no trial, essentially the court has had a trial without giving us the benefit to show up with witnesses and cross-examine.
So we have ample case law, I think, in this context that indicates a district court judge can decide fact issues based on conflicting affidavits. So I guess I'm still not quite following your point.
I'm understanding that, and I'm still saying that it's a de novo review. And I have cases that have so found, and I've presented them to the court. The final point would be whether smoke, there's fire, and none of the judges asked about it, but I still, when I see the smoke and I look back at where it's coming from, I'm really troubled by the pledge agreement that was executed before the parties were divorced, which specifically identifies Mr. Freeze as someone who has an interest in the general contractor. I've not heard any response other than they blew it off. In hindsight, I think it can't be blown off. So my final point.
But counsel, really, I mean, your client was aware of the potential of a purchase before the judgment and decree became final. She had an opportunity to negotiate in the event that the purchase would have gone through. And she didn't.
But she relied. Go ahead.
So why are... Now the district court is finding that there's no fraud or that the evidence that you submitted does not substantiate fraud. And we do credit credibility determinations for conflicting evidence that the district court reaches. So I'm not really grasping the inequity that you're presenting here to us.
Well, the response is she relied upon Mr. Freeze stating that he wasn't have an interest in Stonebridge, despite the fact the pledge agreement says he did. And she relied upon him in saying he has no interest in Stonebridge, and relied upon him in saying the deal's dead. And after secreting his tax return for 3.5 years after it was due, she finds out he had an interest shortly after the decree was entered. She concludes that she was lied to. And that's for this court to determine.
Judge Bradfield, if I may, I actually do have one additional question.
Go right ahead.
Okay, thank you. And this is kind of the flip side of the questions I was asking opposing counsel. So the agreement talks about employment income. It also talks about investment income. It doesn't say anything about basing these calculations on gross income. And even W-2 forms differentiate between employment income, investment income, as well as gross income. So aren't you confined to what the definition of employment income is? In other words, if you wanted to have it broader to include investment income, wouldn't you have used the terms gross income?
Well, I was not there for starters, but it seems to me that the term's not defined, so perhaps reasonable people can disagree on what it includes. I'm suggesting that 518A.29 and 3O are read quite broadly. And secondly, I'm suggesting that if an employer pays someone money, it could be wages, as we've discussed, could be dividend income if he or she is an owner. I say employment income would include both categories.
Thank you.
Sounds
I've
like
concluded, Your Honor.
Nothing further from the panel. And Mr. Haugen, you completed your answer. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, very good. So that completes the arguments before the court today. And